We'll continue with the questions from the audience. The questions were off mic, so I'll repeat them for you.
And with that, I'm happy to take your questions, but thank you for that very warm welcome. And one semi-rule, although I am anarchist about my politics, let's try to have gender balance to make sure, because a lot of times men try to knock women out of the way. So let's, all right, I've been in some terrible places, but it's like, all right, fine, all right.
What do you think that Phil Berrigan would be saying to us if he were here today?
What the question was, what Phil Berrigan would be saying to us today. And I really do want to encourage students who've never heard that name before, look him up, because it's an amazing, amazing story. I mean, the great anyone who knew Phil Berrigan knows one thing, that if there's anything you could say about him, he was remarkably consistent. I think that Phil Berrigan would be protesting the current war and gearing up to protest the next one. And I also think that he would be speaking out about the myth that somehow the world is going to change overnight, or that the nature of U.S. policy is going to change. He understood as well as anyone, better than most, the incredible influence of corporations over U.S. policy and the interwoven nature of the campaign and electoral system with corporations, and how that went to great lengths to dictate U.S. policy. And I think ultimately, what we all, I think, are going to need to gear up for is a realization that it's actually the corporations that are in control of this country. And, in many ways, there's already been a coup in the United States. And it sort of defies the electoral process, because the electoral process becomes irrelevant to the coup, because no one's going to become president who would challenge the coup. And there's this scene in the movie Usual Suspects, where Kevin Spacey's character says the greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist. The corporations run everything already. Our lives are being radically privatized, in front of us. Every aspect of life is increasingly privatized. Schools, healthcare, education, the military, law enforcement, prisons, everything is being privatized. And we have greater control being wielded over others by a smaller and smaller group of people. That to me is the premier issue of our lifetime, is the dominance of corporations over every aspect of our life, because it seeps into every part of our life. And it really does cut across the spectrum too. It's not about being liberal or conservative. I mean, I don't like those labels at all. It's going to impact everyone except that small group of, they're not privileged people. They're people that have stolen from others and refuse to give back. And that's where we have an epic battle that is unfolding in this world, and it's not in vogue to talk about it like this, but it's as simple as this. It's once again the haves and the have-nots. And the haves have more than they ever have, and the have-nots are poorer and poorer around the globe. So until we get away from this false nationalism and realize that we're a part of a bigger world, and realize that it's not just about governments, that it's actually about corporations, I think we're going to be way behind in a game that they've already declared victory on. Yeah. Yes, sir.
There was a time, I remember, when the corporate media fulfilled some of the functions of independent media. They no longer do. What has happened?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting point. I mean, just so people couldn't hear you understand, he was saying that it used to be that the institutions that we now call corporate media outlets perform some of the functions that are now being done by independent media outlets. What I would say about that on a practical level, first of all, is that we have an advertisement-driven agenda in news. And what do I mean by that? We have infotainment now, where advertisers... have at times, and Jeff Cohen knows this well, protested to news outlets about the way they're covering certain stories and try to pressure them or demand that they change it. And if they don't, we'll pull our millions and millions of dollars in advertising revenue that we give you by advertising our products on your networks. And I think it's disturbing that NPR is using so many corporations now. Now, though, you still have some of that happens, but more it's that you have sort of self-censorship at media outlets, where you have a media culture where it's much more important who, what Britney Spears was seen at last night, or you know, how many sugars she put in her massive Frappuccino and how much weight she's gained. It's much more important to harass Britney Spears than it is to do the hard work of embedding with a family of Iraqis and saying, what does their life look like? And I think it's because advertisers simply just don't support programs. It was part of why Ted Koppel, and he had lots of problems. Part of the reason Ted Koppel was forced out of Nightline, and you know, fair, they called it White Line because they pretty much had exclusively white people on the show. But Ted Koppel, I mean, as far as corporate media was concerned, that show, in retrospect now, looks like it was like a radical, like left-wing news hour or something. Nightline, though, it became Ted Koppel was not good for the advertisers. They didn't like them. He wasn't hitting the right demographics, the people who were going to go out and purchase stuff all the time and buy the products that they wanted to push. Why do you think you see all of these commercials for Cialis and Viagra and all these drugs during the day? Who's watching those? What's the demographic? They're going after that middle-aged white guy demographic because they've done their market research and they realize that it's profitable. And so if it's not going to be programming at that hour that those kinds of people are going to watch, then they're going to pull their funding and put it somewhere else. So I think part of it has to do with the ad-driven nature of it. Also, I think it's the fact that in universities, the way journalists are trained or not trained is a scandal in this country. They're taught in many departments across the country to be lemmings or robots, where you learn the AP style of writing, and then you go into the newsroom, and you work your way up, and you're miraculously going to get a job. It goes from internship to newsroom, and you work your way up. And that's, I mean, it seems like a very different vibe here, but I've been at other universities where it's a kind of insane way of teaching journalism. Now, clearly, that's not the case here. But then the other aspect of it, and perhaps this is the most important part of it, is that we don't have a lot of journalists anymore. We have media personalities. We have actors that are posing as journalists who probably wish they were in the theater and couldn't make it, and so instead they're doing the news. And that's a lot of what you have. So the budgets are cut for international bureaus around the world are being shut down. Journalism departments are not teaching muckraking or investigative journalism. They're teaching confirmation journalism. They're teaching deference to the powerful, the way that they're being educated. And then the fact that we just have fewer and fewer journalists. Journalism doesn't pay unless you make it to the top of the world. And we have business schools dwarfing journalism departments across the country. Corporate, education, media personality people, ad-driven. That's how I would answer that. Another woman that wanted to ask something? Yeah, go ahead.
You spoke earlier today about the obligation of journalists to pursue truth rather than favor one political party over another. I'm wondering what you think about the change in objectivity, favoring balance over accuracy, and what advice you would give to student journalists.
Well, first of all, on the issue of balance, the way that balance, I mean, well, you have Fox, Fair and Balance, which is a, you know, it's a sort of laughing stock of serious journalists. I mean, the idea, it used to be funny when they first started doing it. We all thought it was a joke, but it definitely was not a joke. They actually believe this in some perverse way. And, you know, Jeff was making the point that Rupert Murdoch probably was the person who most pushed for the Iraq War on a global scale because he owns so much of the world's powerful media outlets. But balance as defined, for instance, on CNN is James Carville, who was ran Bill Clinton's political campaigns, a Democratic Party insider, or Donna Brazile, who actually, Donna Brazile is probably the best among that lot of Democratic Party hacks who, you know, appear on CNN. That is defined as the sort of left, the anti-war position. And then you have their Republican, you know, counterparts who are the right. Now, the Republican side does a pretty good job of representing the spectrum of right-wing opinion, except the very, very far ends of the loony bin fringe, which is, you know, that you shoot doctors who perform abortions, although they sometimes make it onto these media outlets. But their pundits do a pretty good job of representing the spectrum of opinions on the right. The people that are invited from the dissident viewpoint, the anti-war so-called viewpoint, oftentimes are not really anti-war and are, in fact, just giving the Democratic Party talking points. Almost never is there someone who is not a part of the Democratic Party establishment that is invited to give the alternative opinion on it. It's very rare to have someone who's not affiliated with one of the political parties one way or another, oftentimes publicly, invited onto these programs. In fact, there, you know, Amy Goodman talks about it all the time, but it bears repeating. And Jeff, you'll have to remind me of the number here. But in the lead up to the war, FAIR did this study looking at who was allowed on to the major newscast and the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. And I think out of 400 people that were whose viewpoints were represented on those programs, only three of them were anti-war. Out of 400, three of them were anti-war in the lead-up to the invasion and occupation of Iraq. Now, there were tons of Democrats that were on. There were lots of people that were not Republicans or were not President Bush and his people, but they were not articulating a true anti-war position. And that, to me, is one of the great examples to give in answering your question, because objectivity is defined along partisan lines in oftentimes in both print and on television outlets. In terms of student, you asked about what can student journalists think. It is not a matter, we call it tit for tat, he says, she says, or he says, he says, or she says, she says, or whatever other combination you want. Journalism. There's never just two sides to the story. Oftentimes, the most important perspective of the story is completely left out, and that is the people that will be affected by whatever it is that they're debating, be they Iraqi civilians or people who've lost their homes in the foreclosure or victims of predatory lending. You rarely hear from them except in a soundbite. And I think it's important to try to think outside of the conventional box of tit-for-tat journalism, Democrat, Republican, liberal, conservative. Yeah.
I'm wondering if you had any stories you could share about specifically how your journalism or any type of more progressive journalism has actually changed someone's views, opened their minds up a little bit more to that side of things. I'm asking that because in the last 8 years, the Times have scared the hell out of me. It seems like high school students are the only ones we can grab before they're entrenched in their views and open their minds to the fact that what you see is not what you get. I'm astounded by all these people I know in their 30s, 40s, and 50s who saw politicians flat out lie or be completely wrong and even cause them to lose their job and their money. And their response is, well, they're a little off the mark or really unlucky. It still doesn't sink in.
You know, the some people that I've gotten to know very well over the past few years, particularly covering the Blackwater story, the families of the four guys from Blackwater who were killed in Fallujah on March 31st, 2004. It was this iconic moment of the Iraq War where these guys were, do people know this story? They were ambushed in Fallujah on March 31st, 2004. They were private security guys working for Blackwater. Their bodies were burned. They were dragged through the streets, and then their torsos were strung up from a bridge over the Euphrates River in Fallujah. It was really the week that the war turned in many ways, because it sparked a tremendous uprising around Iraq. Bush unleashed a collective punishment on the people of Fallujah that was watched with horror around the world. And U.S. soldiers started dying in a much more aggressive way because Iraqis rose up against the United States. And I got to know the families of those four guys. And it's interesting because, these four guys came from very, very conservative families, lifelong Republicans. And when their loved ones died, they started to examine. You know, different people, different families have different reactions when their loved one dies in a war zone. But these four families really did a tremendous amount of introspection, but also investigative work themselves. And through the course of investigating how it was that their loved ones ended up dying, guarding empty trucks, working for KBR, the largest war corporation, when what they thought they were doing was going to be bodyguards for the U.S. ambassador, their process, and I got to know them well, their process of studying this and understanding that some of them were very pro-war before the course of this investigation. And then they started to question the war and then became militantly opposed to the war. And I watched that transformation. You know, I shared with stories with one of the widows of one of these guys. We were in D.C. together when they were invited to testify in front of Congress, and they invited me to come down and be with them. So I was with them in their hotel the night before and then accompanied them when they went to testify. And I got to know particularly two of the mothers and one of the widows very well of those guys. And one of the widows of the guys said to me, you know, I finally brought myself to read your book. And they were all very supportive of my the book. And she said, before I read your book, I thought of the people of Iraq as savages. And now to me, they're human beings. And she was talking about reading the reporting that I did about Fallujah and what happened after their loved ones were killed. And what was interesting to me about it is that their perception of what Iraq was, their perception of who the people of Iraq was completely informed by corporate media outlets, completely informed by a cartoonish, disgusting portrayal offered in the corporate media. And the Iraqi Sun were the people that ripped their loved ones limb from limb, burned them, dragged them through the streets, and strung them up from a bridge. And that was the end of it for a lot of them. But they actually, and I give them credit for this, we wanted to understand it. And so, you know, I'm by no means saying that I'm the one responsible for that. But what I'm saying is that those, I've had experiences like that with other military people. I was invited to speak in front of the Marines Memorial Association, and I was introduced by General Mike Myatt, one of the commanders of the Gulf War. I spoke to a room of 400 military people and their families at the Marine Memorial Association, and I got a standing ovation there. And the reason I say that is because they were doing it out of respect, but a lot of them came up to me afterwards, a lot of Marines and former SEALs, including one guy who remains pro-war, whose son was killed at Fallujah, and he said, I disagree with a lot of the things that you said, but I agree with you on the Blackwater issue. I agree with you on the mercenary issue. And to me, I learned a really profound lesson in the course of doing this book, and that is that you never can write off anybody. Because I so many people came out of the woodwork at places where I spoke this, across this country over the past 2 years and blew me away with their ability to not sort of just get into a shouting match or make it a big debate, but to say, you know what, there's a hell of a lot that I disagree with you about, but this thing, I agree with you on that. And it was a this was the lesson I learned. What's more important than ideology, what's more important than whether you're left or right or liberal or conservative, you can find issues in common ground with people and you build from there. Issue-based organizing, issue-based campaigning, to me, that's the future. And this is an old idea, but it's the future of organizing too. That's an old way of viewing the world. That I learned that lesson in a very real way from doing this book and meeting the people that I met and speaking in front of audiences that totally disagreed with me at the beginning, and maybe I brought them around to something, and maybe I learned something from them as well, which I have from a lot of families who remain supportive of the war, who lost loved ones in Iraq. Their stories are very important for people in the anti-war movement to listen to, because these aren't dumb people that just blindly follow the president. The death of their loved one means that the war has to have meant something for them. And that's what you hear from them. And it, you know, when you unpack that and you sit through an evening of a meal with someone who you totally disagree with politically, but they have this story, this way that this big picture that we all look at really, really messed their life up, really turned their world upside down. If you're a real person, you listen to them and you try to understand where they're coming from. And I think I've been changed in the process of listening to those kinds of stories more than I think I've changed anyone. So I'm not saying I support the war by any means, but it's something about the process of learning and listening and understanding. So you had your hand up for a long time.
Barack Obama says we need some transparency, and I'm thinking of the Fourth Estate being a real necessity for that. And he voted against us on the FISA bill. And during the Vietnam War, we were bemoaning that we only had 200 news corporations, and now we've got 5. So what are we looking forward to? And what do you suppose we should be doing?
When people ask you that, it's like, what do you want me to talk for 4 hours? What should we be doing? Well, I think it sort of depends where this is at in life. I believe that the most important place to cast our lot right now is with groups that have been consistent in their opposition to war, and into being against militaristic interpretation of U.S. foreign policy for a long time, much more than partisan politics. I think it's important to keep organizations that have stood against the war afloat, and at the same time to bolster and support independent media outlets. I also think it's really important to realize that there were large segments of the social justice movement in this country that were beaten into the ground by the dark era of the Bush administration, but also co-opted by the Democratic Party in the 2008 election campaign. And I think there's going to be a period of having to re-examine where we go from here. And I think it's going to take a while. But ultimately, I think we have to develop a combination of great online organizing, building independent media, and remembering that the most important thing we can do is to actually be there, be in the streets. So I think it's going to be a return to grassroots, mobilizing, organizing, combined with an embrace of some of the great tools that we have, and especially younger folks have at their disposal. And, you know, there are people in this room that are, you know, a third of the age or a fourth of the age of others who really are probably brilliant on the computer, that combined with the experience of some anti-war people or seasoned journalists or others really could be a force to be reckoned with. So I think it's a matter of trying to diversify our groups And you have a great resource here, I think also in Ithaca College, in the sense that I'm sure there are a lot of students that would welcome the opportunity to get involved if they knew that it was available to them or was out there. I mean, that might not be the answer you're looking for, but that's the most genuine answer I can think of right now in terms of the context of being here in Ithaca. Let's try to get a woman, and then I'll come back to you, sir, okay? Yes, go ahead.
You mentioned your earlier poverty activism. Last semester, I spent a week volunteering at the Community for Nonviolence, and the conditions were absolutely horrible. I was wondering whether you had any plans to increase awareness of homeless issues at that center and at other shelters in the country.
Yeah, well, I don't know if you guys saw this report, too, but there's been a dramatic increase in the number of soup kitchens and homeless shelters. I mean, Reagan, you know, used to brag about how under his administration, you know, the number of soup kitchens like tripled or something, as though it was something to brag about. And they were serving his favorite vegetable, ketchup. But I hear the age of people laughing at that joke. I think it's we are now in a situation where the rug has been pulled out from under so many people. And we have well over a million young men and women who have gone in and out of Iraq that have varying degrees of post-traumatic stress disorder that are going to have serious medical needs, both physically and mental health-wise. We're going to see a tremendous rise in alcoholism, in abuse of drugs. We're going to see a rise in domestic violence, and we're going to see a rise in homelessness in this country. And I think that you know, if those of us that try to live lives without ever seeing the reality that millions of Americans and others in this country face every day, it's eventually going to hit all of us. And you know, if there's one massive lesson that this country should have learned from Hurricane Katrina, it's how fragile society actually is here. It was a window into what could happen across this country in any number of circumstances, where you can have the systematic neglect and abandonment of people, and then the vultures swooping in to try to redraw the demographics of an area, particularly of a historically black area or an area that had one culture, and now they're going to wipe it out and try to invent a different one there. I, in terms of me trying to raise awareness on it, you know, I my focus has primarily been foreign policy, and I think that you know, you should do that, and other people should do that, because we have a huge mess in this world, and each of us need to take responsibility for a small part of it, I think. Yes. Oh, in Katrina. All right. Okay, let him ask this question, then I'll go to that. I'm going to tell you a story about New Orleans in a second, but go ahead, sir.
I had a daymare that the Blackwater-type mercenaries, if they get back in this country and they're not dissolved, they'll be like a Praetorian guard that will threaten everybody and make and break the emperor. It scares me. Do you feel that the persons who caused this war should be held to account?
Are you kidding in asking me that question? Do I think that the people who did all this should be held to account? Look, I think that if President Bush is smart, he'll realize he doesn't need to preemptively pardon himself, because the Justice Department under Obama is not going to go after him. I was on Michael Ratner, and Michael Ratner is one of the great freedom fighters in our society, the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who stood up and said, we'll defend the Guantanamo prisoners, when no one else would do that, not even the ACLU at the time. They stood up and did that. I was on Michael Ratner's radio show, Law and Disorder, the other day, and we were talking about the idea of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. This all over the internet right now. People are saying we need a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. What we're going to get with Obama is the Reconciliation Commission, but no truth. And what Michael Ratner is saying, we don't need a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. We need criminal prosecutions. And I think that's an area where I think we really need to apply pressure on the Justice Department under Barack Obama and say, no forgiveness of these crimes. They are unconscionable, and they need to be prosecuted. Now, I don't have any illusion that that's going to happen, because it's an unwritten rule in U.S. politics that you sort of let bygones be bygones and get onto the business of expanding the reach of the empire. And I think that's ultimately what's going to happen. However, having said that, the Center for Constitutional Rights fully intends to sue Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, and George Bush in the United States and outside of the United States, and they want to make it so that they cannot leave this country and go to Europe without fear of being prosecuted. Now, you know, when Augusto Pinochet had the warrant for his arrest and was put under house arrest in Britain a few years ago, there were reports that Henry Kissinger was afraid to leave the country for fear that that would happen to him. Rumsfeld has had to cancel trips to Europe because of the attempts to prosecute him in Europe. So while we may not get Obama around to taking up these prosecutions, mark my words, we have a whole team and a long list of lawyers that will work on this that are going to make it their number one priority to hold them accountable for their crimes. I don't think it's any substitute for criminal prosecutions in this country, but that's probably the best we can hope for, is to support the work of the Center for Constitutional Rights and their allies as they try to hold them accountable for the crimes they've committed over the course of the past 8 years in this country. One of the reasons why the Democrats won't do it is because it's their crimes too. One senator voted against the Patriot Act. His name was Russ Fine from Wisconsin, and I'm from Wisconsin. Most of them voted for the war. Most of them have voted to continually fund it. Most of them voted to give retroactive immunity to telecommunications companies that allowed their networks to be used for spying on us. And then Obama's convention is sponsored by one of those companies right after he votes for them, AT&T. So the Democrats aren't going to open up that can of worms because they're complicit in it. So we go back to the same people who are consistent, and Michael Ratner, who will be the same lawyer under Obama as he was under Bush. Oh, the Praetorian Guard. I don't know that I would go that far with it. I mean, I think, you know, look, people have talked about, will there be a coup against Obama or something like that, or would there be people? I mean, would that we actually had a person that could become president of this country that actually would make the corporate power structure in this country afraid? We don't have that. If we did, we would have to be worried about that kind of a scenario. Blackwater will be integrated into that administration. They'll continue to work for the United States government. Under an Obama administration, I think they'll be around for a long, long time. Their presence in the United States, and this is what Jeff had asked me to talk about, I encountered them in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina when I was in the French Quarter interviewing two New York City police officers who had come down. This was a few days after the flooding of the city began, and there was no FEMA to speak of. I don't know that they've arrived yet in New Orleans, but they weren't there. And this car speeds up next to us, and three massive guys get out of it with M4 assault rifles, khaki uniforms, bulletproof gear, M4 assault rifles, Glock 9 strapped to their legs. And they came up and they said, "Where are the rest of the Blackwater guys?" And you know, the fact was that Blackwater had beaten every agency of the federal government to the hurricane zone. And Eric Prince, the owner of the company, sent 184 of his men onto the streets of New Orleans. And when I interviewed them, they told me that they were there to confront criminals and stop looters. Some of these guys had just been in Iraq 2 weeks earlier. These are former Navy SEALs, Delta Force, 82nd Airborne, on the streets of a U.S. city saying they were there to confront criminals and stop looters. And Eric Prince, the owner of Blackwater, decided he was going to do this with no government contract. He just sent them there on August 29th, 2005, because he wanted to send his men out to stop the looters, as they were calling them. Well, 8 days after he first sent them in, I like to say it's like a reverse biblical story. On the eighth day, the Bush administration hired Blackwater on a no-bid contract to be the official bodyguard force for FEMA, and they made over $70 million on those operations. Blackwater was hardly the only mercenary company to deploy in New Orleans. I interviewed Israeli commandos that had been flown in from Galveston, Texas by helicopter, and they landed in a park across the street from a private gated community. And the gated community had hired this company of Israeli commandos called Instinctive Shooting International, ISI. They had the logo on their uniform. Look it up. It's a real company that exists. They operated an armed checkpoint where they were stopping cars and stopping individuals on the streets of a U.S. city. These were Israeli commandos hired by a wealthy businessman who had just been quoted in the Wall Street Journal as saying that if the demographics of New Orleans don't change, meaning if we don't get rid of the black people, we, meaning the powerful white people, are going to leave. This was the guy who brought in the Israeli commandos and positioned them on the streets of a U.S. city. I tell you that story in response to your question about the Praetorian Guard because, A, I don't think that they need them in that way. But, B, I think that the wealthy in this country, corporations, they have their own domestic policy. their own foreign policy. BlackRock just started its own CIA called Total Intelligence Solutions. They're marketing CIA services to Fortune 500 corporations. It's headed by one of the biggest thugs to ever serve in the U.S. government, Kofor Black, who ran the CIA's counterterrorism center after 9/11, oversaw the extraordinary rendition torture program. He's now running Blackwater's private CIA. You see, what would happen in New Orleans is that we had Baghdad on the bayou, where all of these war companies that had made a killing in Iraq came in for disaster profiteering, and they started whole divisions of their companies to service domestic operations inside of the United States. This has metastasized so quickly and spread so fast that to remove it from the body politic of the United States or remove it from U.S. society would require having 450 at least different people in Congress who actually would be willing to take on these corporations. That was a window into our future, and a window, more importantly, into the present for millions of people in this country whose stories go unreported and undocumented. Yes, they're a threat to the democratic society, but not to those in power, to the rest of us. And that, to me, is the point. Do we have time for one more?
Two more?
Okay. Let's. We'll come to you. Was there a woman over there? Yeah, you and then you.
I'm curious about what you want to say about the effect of Jon Stewart's comedy show on young people.
I mean, look, I think Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert do a better job of bringing news and doing actual reporting than almost any corporate media outlets. I mean, in fact, I'm a news junkie, and I unfortunately am in a situation where I have to have cable news on all day. I mean, I watch more. I know who all these people are. I feel like Wolf Blitzer lives in my house or something, you know, and he and his hologram. I had Jessica Yellen was beaming into my house the other day or something. But I always, you know, I always try to watch The Daily Show or Colbert because it's a very good summary of what happened during the day. Oftentimes, the one criticism that I would offer of Jon Stewart is that he has these insane lunatic right wingers on and just treats them like they're his great friends. And I mean, sometimes he'll go after somebody and sometimes he'll do a really good job going after them. But like Bill Kristol will go on that show, one of the godfathers of the neoconservative movement. And it's as though, you know, cousin Carl has come to eat mashed potatoes or something. And it's like, no, this is Bill Kristol. He was a tremendous, tremendous, like evil individual when it came to the buildup for the war in Iraq and everything else. And, you know, the New York Times now, he has a column. But Stewart sort of treats those guys in a way that he doesn't treat. Like whenever a progressive ends up on that show, odds are that something awkward is going to happen to them or Stewart's going to really go after them in an aggressive way. So that'll be my one criticism. I'll tell you my own personal story. Stewart was kind of a jerk to me when I went on that show. He threw my book off the table. He spoke from Blackwater's talking points. I mean, I really felt like I was on Fox News when I was on The Daily Show. And then after, he was saying, like, I don't get it. What's the problem with this? If we need more soldiers in Iraq, why not send over Blackwater? Like, I don't get it. After the massacre happened last September, Stewart did this show where Chris Matthews had been on, the host of Hardball on MSNBC, and Matthews had said to him, you know, this is the worst interview I've ever done in my life. The next night, Jon Stewart replays part of that, plays and says, you have no idea what a bad interview is. He's like, I do bad interviews all the time. You know, that you weren't even the worst interview of my week. In fact, you want to see a bad interview. And then he shows a clip of himself interviewing me and juxtaposes it with, what's the problem? Blackwater mercenaries killed 17 Iraqi civilians. They said that they are unprovoked gunfire, blah, blah, blah. And he said, sometimes it just goes to show that I don't know what the F I'm talking about. Amy Goodman played it and said, Jon Stewart, you should have Jerry Hill back on. And he got thousands and thousands of emails and he never had me back on. And then lo and behold, I'm in Denver for the Democratic National Convention. And I get on the plane to go from Denver to St. Paul to cover the Republican National Convention. And I'm walking on the plane. And of course, sitting in first class, there's Jon Stewart. And I know some of the producers and stuff. And I was saying hi to them. And I see Stewart there. And I've never talked to him since then. And Stewart has his baseball cap on. And he's, you know, I can't help but laugh when I see Jon Stewart because he's funny. And so, and Stewart looks, he looks up at me and he goes like that. He goes, all right, all right, all right. You were right. I was wrong. There you have it. And then I proceeded to, you know, to my middle seat by the toilet in the back. So anyway, all right. The last question then was from, yeah, you.
I'm wondering why you have animosity to Biden and some of the choices in Obama's cabinet.
Not animosity. Truth. Yeah.
I'm under the impression that Congress was greatly, greatly misled about some of the intelligence that they were given to begin the Iraq War, so it wouldn't necessarily be on them. I'm trying to get my facts straight.
Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, the myth laboratory that was erected to support the war in Iraq really was the it was built during the Clinton administration. The lies started in the 1990s about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction program, and that's something really that Scott Ritter has talked about consistently. The idea that the Democrats were misled, which became the dominant narrative, is I'll put it in a blunt term: it's a flat out lie. The Democrats on the let me tell you why it's a lie. The Democrats had access to a wide range of intelligence that they had reviewed. And I know people that sit on the Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. I'm talking about people that are in Congress that serve on the committee. And they say when Hillary Clinton stands up and says that she was misled by the Bush administration, she is misleading the American people. They had access to a wide variety of information. They could weigh various intelligence reports against others. They knew clearly that the Bush administration was politicizing intelligence. Why is it that that 130 members of the House of Representatives managed to see clearly and Hillary Clinton couldn't? Hillary Clinton had better access to intelligence than a lot of them, and compounded by the fact that she was in the White House for 8 years in the 1990s and knew very, very well the state of Saddam's lack of a weapons of mass destruction program. Joe Biden had access to anyone he wanted to talk to with the subpoena power of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Had he wanted to challenge the administration's contention or bring in any dissenting voice from the CIA or from the intelligence community, he could have done that. And they could have had these people testify publicly. That is one of the great frauds of this war, was the idea that the Democrats were somehow misled. That was what John Kerry tried to hide behind in the 2004 campaign. These guys were saying this before Bush was in office. They were saying it before Cheney went over and told the CIA what the intelligence should say. So, you know, the only reason I corrected you on in sort of your characterization is because if you're not in this country angry at the idea that people with these records are being brought back into power with no scrutiny whatsoever and are being celebrated as the new face of American foreign policy, and you actually do know their history, it should make you upset to see that these people are being brought back in, and the scandal that's going to end up happening is Eric Holder might not be confirmed as Attorney General because he was involved deeply with the pardoning of Mark Rich. If there's a reason why Eric Holder should not be confirmed as Attorney General, it's because he has voluntarily defended as a lawyer the Chiquita Banana Company, which was engaged in human rights abuses in Latin America. The reason that I maybe you pick up this tone from me is because I think that we're living in a fairy tale land right now. Many people who think that the job is done because Barack Obama won. The real work begins now, and it's like people are packing up and going home. These are people with histories, and it's very, very important that we remind ourselves who they are, because we're going to be living with them, and others will be dying under them for many years to come. Thanks for your question, Will.
Jeremy Scahill, radio journalist and author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army, speaking December 2nd at the Park Center for Independent Media in Ithaca, New York. Thanks to Jeff Cohen, Brandy Hawley, and Tom Inman for their assistance in making the recording possible. The CEOs of the big three U.S. automakers were on Capitol Hill again last week, requesting financial help from the government to stave off bankruptcy. Whether that help should be given or not has been a hot topic in the media and among the public. Those opposing the bailout from the right in Congress and the press have often focused on the wages and benefits of the unionized workers as the source of the company's unprofitability. The host of one financial show I heard expressed how angry he was that retired workers were being paid so much to sit at home and watch television. He did not consider it a problem that retired CEOs and rich stockholders were paid even greater sums while playing golf. As Susan Rosenthal has been pointing out in her 2006 book, Power and Powerlessness, the capitalist class produces nothing and seizes the surplus from those who do, yet this is not considered a problem. In fact, it is heresy to suggest that it is. Appropriately, we're going to resume our reading of chapter 13, decide which side you're on, with the topic of unions. Unions. Workers form unions to protect themselves from the insatiable demands of employers. A union worker is more likely to have medical coverage, pension benefits, and protection from sexual harassment and wrongful discipline or dismissal. Compared with states with fewer unions, states with more unions enjoy higher wages, more medical coverage, higher life expectancy, lower infant mortality, less poverty, more money for education, and lower workplace fatalities for everyone. Patients also do better in hospitals where nurses are unionized. Sadly, the unions of today are a pale shadow of what they used to be. Janora Johnson Dollinger describes the confidence of auto workers who organized General Motors in 1937. Quote, every time something came up that couldn't be settled, or the workers got a tough foreman who told them to go to hell, they'd shut down the line. The men were so cocky they'd say to the foreman, "You don't like it?" They'd push the button and shut down the line. Close quote. The power of organized workers frightened and enraged the capitalists, who realized the only way to tame the unions was to gut them of socialists and other class-conscious militants. With the support of President Roosevelt, employers began to attack unions and union organizers. In 1938, Congress formed the Special Committee on Un-American Activities to rout out, quote, radical subversives. In Subterranean Fire, A History of Working-Class Radicalism in the United States, Sharon Smith explains how conservative union officials worked hand-in-hand with the state to drive socialists out of the unions. Stripped of their fighting core, unions were transformed from fighting organizations controlled by workers into bureaucratic organizations run by middle-class professionals. There are middle-class unions composed of police, doctors, and other professionals. However, most unions function within the gray zone between the classes. Unions are working-class organizations of self-defense and are also part of the management system of capitalism. Most ordinary union members, known as the rank and file, are working-class people, while union officials are mostly middle-class professionals. The job of these officials is to mediate between bosses and workers to negotiate the terms on which workers will be exploited. Most unions have a large working class base and a much smaller middle class leadership. Workers who get a few hours off of work to conduct union business are still working class. Even some full-time union organizers are working class because they are kept on a short leash by union officials. Other organizers are trusted to know the rules of the game and to make the right decisions, like any other middle-class professional. The higher someone rises in the union hierarchy, the more managerial functions that person performs. Union officials with the power to hire and fire clerical and other support staff are solidly middle class. Top union officials who help the government set policy are upper middle class. Union officials, also called union bureaucrats, have the same goal as employers, keeping the company in business. And that means keeping it competitive. The website of America's largest union organization, the AFL-CIO, boasts that, quote, unions are good for productivity. Unions increase productivity according to most recent studies. The voice that union members have on the job, sharing in decision-making about promotions and work and production standards, increases productivity and improves management practices. Better training, lower turnover, and longer tenure also make union workers up to 38% more productive, close quote. In reality, productivity can increase only by reducing the amount of surplus that goes to the workers who produce it. From the 1940s through the 1960s, unions supported management drives to raise productivity and profits, bargaining away workers' control on the job in exchange for higher wages and better benefits. This changed in the 1970s when employers declared war on the working class to push productivity even higher. Most unions did not fight back because the tradition of fighting back was lost when militants were purged from the unions. Union officials agreed to help employers downsize and restructure in the hope that if workers helped companies to become more profitable, companies would reciprocate by rewarding workers for their sacrifice. Unfortunately, capitalism is not based on reciprocity, but on seize the surplus. The more profits rose, the more employers demanded. At each step of this process, union officials protested loudly, then conceded to the employers' demands. As the economy boomed, workers' conditions deteriorated. Some unions did fight. In December of 1984, members of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, UFCW, decided not to accept wage cuts at their meatpacking plant in Minnesota. In hard-pressed in the heartland, the Hormel strike and the future of the labor movement, Peter Ratchlove writes, quote, "Over the first half of the 1980s, no local had been able to stand up to the corporate pressure for concessions or the international union's acquiescence. Local P9's willingness to take a stand thus threatened the international union nearly as much as it threatened the Hormel Corporation. P9 quickly came to symbolize democracy and membership participation, a willingness to oppose corporate demands for concessions, regardless of international union agendas or strategies, and a form of horizontal solidarity that threatened the vertical, bureaucratic hold that international unions exercised over their locals. As thousands of workers poured into Austin to express their support, we likened their experience to catching a virus from P9. But the UFCW and the AFL-CIO were determined to prevent the spread of this virus." Close quote. In May of 1985, the executive board of the UFCW removed the elected leadership of Local P9 and put a union bureaucrat in charge. As the new local president, Joe Hansen signed Hormel's concession contract. While conditions in the meatpacking industry continue to deteriorate, Hansen defends his role in the P9 strike, stating, quote, "It's because of me that there's still a union in that plant," close quote. In fact, concession contracts do not preserve unions. By 2005, the percentage of private sector workers in unions had dropped to under 8%, the lowest rate in more than a century. In 2005, the crisis in the labor movement provoked a split in the AFL-CIO. While both sides of this split pledged to organize more workers into unions, neither is committed to fighting the employers. Strikes deplete union funds and risk driving the employer out of business or out of town. As long as union officials accept the logic of capitalism, they will inevitably side with management to put profit before human needs. In any sane world, a social system that could not function without eroding people's living standards would be replaced. Instead of taking that road, union bureaucrats lower their members' expectations of what can be achieved. The union bureaucracy is a managerial class that fears rousing the rank and file. At times, union officials will talk tough and even lead militant struggles, only to crumble under employer pressure. When workers rebel in wildcat strikes, union officials do everything they can to get workers back on the job. Some people think that unions have become so corrupt and useless that they are not worth defending. This is a big mistake. The capitalist class continues to attack unions because they stand in the way of bosses having complete control over the workplace. Workers need unions, and unions must be defended against those who would destroy them. The best defense would be for workers to take collective control of their unions and transform them into fighting organizations that can win real gains for working people. More on this later. A few solid labor victories would energize the entire working class and raise expectations of what can be achieved. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. Unions and the state. Just as union officials partner with employers to manage the workplace, America's top union bureaucrats partner with the American state to manage the world. Without the awareness or consent of their members, top executives in the AFL-CIO have helped to overthrow democratically elected governments, prop up anti-union dictators, support right-wing unions against progressive governments. Kim Sipes found that, quote, "Before the First World War, the American Federation of Labor engaged in counteracting revolutionary forces in Mexico during that country's revolution, actively worked to support and defend U.S. government participation in the First World War, and then led the charge within U.S. foreign policy circles against the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. The AFL-CIO established its own Latin American operation in 1962, the American Institute for Free Labor Development, to better respond to challenges within the region. Among other activities, AIFLD helped lay the groundwork for the military coups against democratically elected governments in Guatemala in 1954, Brazil in 1964, and Chile in 1973. These efforts in Latin America were paralleled in Africa and Asia." Close quote. In 1999, the Advisory Committee on Labor Diplomacy, ACLD, was established as a forum for top labor leaders to advise the federal government. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright addressed one ACLD meeting, quote, "When you undertook your lives as labor leaders, becoming a part of the U.S. government may have not been something that you intended, but I do think it has been a very important partnership. I think that is the best way to describe it." Close quote. Sections of the labor movement have protested union support for U.S. imperialism. The California Federation of Labor publicly criticized the AFL-CIO for backing right-wing organizations that tried to oust Venezuela's elected president, Hugo Chavez. The class conflict between union officials and rank-and-file workers is expressed in this statement from the South Bay Labor Council. Quote, "There's no solidarity when labor becomes a go-between, laundering funds and resources from the Bush administration and passing them to groups abroad. That role is more appropriate for government agents, agents of empire. We believe that international labor solidarity must come from the heart of the workers in one country to the heart of the workers in another country, a reciprocal relationship." Close quote. Class and consciousness. The capitalist class benefits from exploiting the working class. The working class benefits when it resists the capitalist class. The middle class vacillates, supporting one class and then the other or both at the same time. The question immediately arises, if the working class is the majority of society, creating all the wealth of society, why does it allow the capitalist class to exploit it? Part 3 explained how the capitalist class imposes its will on society through outright lies, by blaming the victim, through divide and rule, and by assaulting children. These methods succeed only because people can be bamboozled into thinking that their enemies are really their friends. The flexibility of human consciousness is both a strength and a weakness. The ability to learn, change, and adapt is a strength. The capacity to be deceived is a weakness. As every con artist knows, people can be deceived into acting against their own interests. Priests convince women that using birth control is sinful, and politicians convince the poor to kill each other in wars that benefit the rich. People can also resist indoctrination. Most Catholics use birth control despite church doctrine. And American sailor Pablo Paredes preferred to go to prison than to fight an immoral war in Iraq. People can choose what they think. However, they don't choose in a vacuum. People in different social classes have different life experiences that influence what they believe. A rich person's experience of being served feeds the belief that she is a superior being. A working woman's life of drudgery feeds the belief that she doesn't deserve better. A shopkeeper's frustration with her employees feeds the belief that workers are lazy and irresponsible. A worker's life of hard work and low pay feeds anger and bitterness. Even though class strongly influences what people believe, class does not determine consciousness. In theory, anyone from any class can believe anything. To stay in power, the capitalist class must ensure that certain ideas, like private property and inequality, dominate society. However, the ideas that support the capitalist system conflict with most people's experience. The belief that hard work will lead to a better life conflicts with the reality of working 2 and 3 jobs for minimum wage and getting nowhere. The belief that the people in charge are superior conflicts with their obvious incompetence when it comes to practical matters. The capitalist class faces a huge challenge. It must coerce workers into disregarding their own experience in order to view themselves and the world through the eyes of their oppressors. The conflict between the classes must be transformed into a conflict inside the worker, causing confusion and internal doubt. The resulting lack of confidence helps keep workers subordinate. Class conflict is rooted in the fact that one class does the work and a different class reaps the benefits. To maintain this inequality, the ruling class promotes the view that everyone has the same interests, that class conflict is no more than an attitude or a state of mind. In reality, as long as humanity is divided into antagonistic classes, people will have to take sides. Those who advocate class neutrality are not neutral at all. They support the status quo that favors the capitalist class. Consider a nurse's strike. Management accuses nurses of harming patients by withdrawing services. Nurses condemn management for harming patients by not hiring enough staff. Both sides claim to represent the patient's interests. Which side would you support? If the hospital were a metaphor for society, would you be on the side of the capitalist class or the working class? Capitalists insist that what is good for business is good for society. Workers insist that what is good for workers is good for society. Capitalists want a world where profits keep climbing and they are firmly in control. The capitalist dream is a nightmare for workers who long for meaningful work and freedom from authoritarian control. The middle class can see both sides and advocates compromise. However, the rule of compete or die makes compromise impossible. The employer who agrees to pay higher wages will fall behind his competitor who refuses to compromise. Workers who curb their demands find the employer demanding even more to stay competitive. As long as the two classes are locked in combat over the surplus, there are only 3 choices: to side with the ruling class, to side with the working class, or vacillate with the middle class. Let's examine which class best represents the interest of humanity, starting with the class in power. And we'll have to get to that examination in our reading next week. I've been reading from the book Power and Powerlessness by Dr. Susan Rosenthal, published in 2006. We'll continue with the reading next week. In the meantime, you can obtain the entire book in various ways through the author's website at susanrosenthal.com. Over the coming weeks, We'll be reading the book together, and at the end, I'll be interviewing Dr. Rosenthal and asking her my questions and yours, if you'll submit them to me via email. You can contact me through the email link at the Unwelcome Guests website at unwelcomeguests.org, where MP3 downloads of this and all previous episodes are also available. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Just like